I'm Brandi Cruz. Coming up today on Undivided, election year lawfare is getting a lot of attention because of what's happening with former President Donald Trump, but an awful lot of it happens in local elections too. We'll have some examples. Plus, Bob Ferguson opposes the initiatives that his office now gets to add warning labels to. Doesn't seem very fair to me. And finally, SCOTUS could decide to hear a case on Washington State's eviction moratorium. We'll have a legal expert join us. That and more coming up today on Undivided. Remember, you can support our show for just $5 a month by signing up at undividedpod.com. Hello, 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 and welcome to Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you so much for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. A lot of good stuff on the show today that you are simply not going to hear about anywhere else. We are talking a lot about, and I think nationally, the conversation around lawfare and what's happening with former President Donald Trump and this belief by some that he would not be going through these prosecutions if he weren't running again to be president of the United States for another term. I happen to believe some of that is true. I certainly don't excuse everything that Donald Trump has done. But that doesn't mean that I think you can believe that he hasn't been an above board kind of guy like a lot of politicians. But I also think at the same time, you can understand that he's being pursued so relentlessly for political reasons. And that's where I sit. But this idea of lawfare is really nothing new. You know, trying to bog down political opponents in legal cases, even prosecutions, or in trying to utilize election laws and try to spin them against candidates who you might not like or might not support and hope that a couple of them stick. So, you know, election year lawfare is fairly typical. And we're seeing a lot of that locally. And I thought I'd go over some of it because two examples of election year lawfare have to do with our show. So I thought, well, why don't we go through them and let you guys know how we're being woven into these attempts at lawfare. One of them has to do with State Senator Mark Mullett, a moderate Democrat, who is, of course, running for governor against Bob Ferguson. How dare he? And one of Bob Ferguson's legal buddies filed an ethics complaint with the Legislative Ethics Board against Mark Mullett. So this is the complaint. The complaint alleges that respondent violated the Ethics Act by commenting on his opponent in the governor's race while appearing on the air, while sitting in his legislative office, using legislative equipment during the 2024 session. So basically they're saying, hey, he's running for governor. He's also a sitting state senator. And he did a news interview in his office where he's talking crap about Bob Ferguson. And they said that that violated legislative ethics. Now, here's where we come in. The interview in question was, in fact, an interview that Senator Mark Mullett did on the Undivided podcast back in February of this year. Respondent appeared on Brandi Cruz's show Undivided on February 28th, 2024. The complete running time of the show is 30 plus minutes. Respondent's portion was about 12 minutes. During the interview, Ms. Cruz asked respondent multiple questions about the initiatives that were currently before the legislature. Respondent discussed the initiatives that would receive legislative hearings and those that would not. They also discussed several bills pending before the legislature. Ms. Cruz asked the respondent, Mark Mullett, several questions about the initiative that would affect the Climate Commitment Act. So you might be wondering, okay, what's the big deal? Senator Mark Mullett came on my show in February during the legislative session from his legislative office, spoke to me as a legislator about the initiatives that were before the legislature. Nothing wrong with that. But one of Bob Fergie's legal buddies, ended up honing in on this particular clip when I asked Mark Mullett, again, here's from our show, about whether he personally, in November, would vote to repeal the CCA.
I have zero confidence that Bob Ferguson will do anything different than what Jay Inslee has done, which is he will just drive up prices as high as possible. And so if that is the case, where if I'm looking at, you know, a chance of Bob Ferguson being governor, like, yeah, I would be extremely uncomfortable with that possibility.
That's it. He didn't say anything about his campaign for governor. And in case you're not familiar, there's a clear distinction. So if you are running a campaign, let's say that you're a state representative and you are, you know, in session, but you're also running a reelection campaign, you can't mix the two. You can't talk about your reelection campaign and use your state office and your state resources to do a news interview talking about your reelection campaign while you're doing an interview as a sitting state representative. And so it's true that you can't kind of mix business and pleasure, business and campaigning like that. But all Mark Mullett did, all he did in answering a question from me about initiatives before the legislature is suggest that if Bob Ferguson were to become governor, he probably would vote to repeal the CCA because he wouldn't trust how Bob Ferguson would handle the CCA. He wouldn't trust Bob Ferguson to fix the CCA and some of the glaring issues with the CCA that result in the higher gas prices. He didn't talk at all about his campaign for governor. But that didn't stop Bob Ferguson from having one of his legal buddies file an ethics complaint anyway. And as I would expect, the ethics complaint was just dismissed. This from the Legislative Ethics Board. Although Mark Mullett mentioned Bob Ferguson in his comments during the show, it appears to be a somewhat ambiguous comment in an otherwise legitimate discussion about initiatives to the legislature and other pending legislation. The question and respondent's response constituted approximately 23 seconds of the 12-plus minute interview that Mark Mullett participated in. Having considered the respondent's comments and all of the circumstances, the board finds that further proceedings would not serve the purpose of the Ethics Act. It is hereby ordered. The complaint is dismissed. What you're basically saying, Bob Ferguson being thin-skinned and having his legal buddies go and find little 23-second clips that he can try to take to the Ethics Board and, you know, oh, how dare Mark Mullett run against me as a Democrat? Let's find some things to go after him for. What they're arguing in making that complaint, essentially, is that sitting members of the legislature can't criticize another public official. No, Mark Mullett, he's running against him for governor, but he has every right in his legislative capacity to criticize Bob Ferguson, to criticize how he would handle the CCA, to criticize the fact that he wouldn't do anything to help reduce CCA costs for working class families. And that's what the Legislative Board of Ethics found, is that Mark Mullett did nothing wrong. So Mark Mullett won in election year lawfare, Bob Ferguson zero. Let's move on, shall we? Now to an election year lawfare effort from the right. I'm proud of this, by the way. Dave Reichert's first PDC complaint of his campaign is about me. Oh, I take such pride in that. I love it. So this is the complaint filed against Dave Reichert's gubernatorial campaign. Alleged violation of state law for failure to timely and accurately report contributions and expenditures. Let's take a look into this complaint, shall we? It was filed by a man named Eric Crowell. Nice picture of him here. So in this complaint, Eric Crowell, who is a citizen of Washington State, alleges that I spoke at a Dave Reichert event for free and I cannot do that. That if I spoke at a Dave Reichert event, Dave Reichert would have to list it as an in-kind contribution to the PDC. Now, I'm going to talk about that in a moment, but let's dive a little bit more into Eric Crowell, shall we? Let's see here. So Eric Crowell runs a Twitter account called Outrage Pacific Northwest, which I'm blocked on now. So he files his PDC complaints from behind a block screen. Let's see. He also has a shady past. Armed man who filmed Portland police returns to jail because he violated the terms of his pretrial release. Yeah, apparently he was creepily outside a police precinct with a huge cache of weapons, but I digress. You know, it's the only picture of him I had is his booking photo. Oh, he also happens to be a contributor to Semi Bird's campaign. So this PDC report gets filed by Eric Crowell, and then he takes to his Twitter page, not acknowledging that he's the one who filed it, right? And he says, breaking news, the Washington PDC has opened an investigation into these unreported in-kind contributions made to the Reichert campaign by Brandy Cruz. I love how he's like, breaking news on the report you filed with the PDC. And also when you said opened an investigation, that's not really how it works. The PDC gets complaints, the complaints go up on their website, and then they look into whether the complaints are valid. So I could file a complaint today saying Bob Ferguson is actually a space alien in disguise here to destroy the planet, and the PDC would have to open an investigation into my complaint. So it's just sort of a matter of course. Now let's get to the actual meat of this PDC complaint. So it all centers around this idea that because I sometimes do keynote speeches and charge people to do keynote speeches, that I can't simply decide to speak at Dave Reichert events for free. So the gist of this complaint is that the PDC should be able to regulate and put a monetary value on my free speech, which is just inherent patently stupid on its face and unconstitutional. But Eric Kral points to this tweet that I sent out, and this is the only tweet that he includes in his PDC complaint. It's taken out of context. I'll give you the full context coming up in a moment. But here's the tweet he included a screen grab of in his complaint. Yes, actually, I did speak at a Dave Reichert event for free, but keep making things up. If I didn't speak for free, he would have had to list it in his PDC filings. So Eric Kral took that tweet and in his PDC complaint takes it completely out of context, saying that Brandy is admitting here that she spoke at a Dave Reichert event for free so he could avoid listing her contribution with the PDC, which isn't what I'm saying at all. If you look at the actual in-context tweets in terms of what I'm replying to, I was replying to a series of tweets where people were accusing me. There was a guy on Twitter called Purple Dog accusing me of being paid by the Reichert camp to support his campaign. She's paid by Reichert and Future 42 to do this. He says, you don't speak at Dave Reichert events for free. So I responded and said, yes, actually, I do speak at Dave Reichert events for free. Totally supporting him for free. And the point I'm making is if I didn't do it for free, you would see it listed in the PDC. If I charge Dave Reichert to speak at his event, he would have to file that with the PDC. So that's the point I'm making here. It's not that I spoke for free to hide it from the PDC. No, I spoke for free because I can speak for free whenever I want, to whomever I want, for whatever reason I want. That's my First Amendment right. And you certainly can't, the PDC or any government entity can't tell me who I can speak to free for free for. That's absolutely absurd. I would also point out, and this will be part of the PDC investigation process, I'm sure they'll reach out to me about it, even though it should just be dismissed on its face, because again, they can't tell me that I can't exercise my First Amendment rights for free to whomever I want. I speak at an awful lot of events for free. One of the things that Eric Kral said in his complaint is Brandy usually charges $2,500 for keynote speeches, and he provides some records that of organizations I've spoke for, like to Republican Party groups, where I charge them $2,500. Yeah, that's because if I don't have a personal connection to a group and they want me to spend time on my schedule, you know, putting a speech together, coming to an event, yeah, I'm going to charge them to give a keynote speech. But I will say I do free events as much as, or if not more than I do paid events. So, I mean, I have a long list of events that I have done this year for free that I don't charge. I really never charge for emceeing events, only for keynote speeches. I mean, Nicole, I'm just trying to think of a few I did. I did Roanoke this year for free. I did the Seattle Police Foundation for free. I did the Snohomish County Canine Auction for free. I have an event for free coming up on Wednesday, an event for free coming up on Saturday. I just booked an event for September for free. So, yeah, I get to decide whether I want to charge someone to come speak to them or whether I want to do it for free because I believe in what they're doing. And I will continue to speak at Dave Reichert events for free. I will continue to introduce Dave Reichert at fundraising events for free. I will continue if he'd like to MC Dave Reichert events for free. And the PDC absolutely cannot regulate the monetary value of my words. But just an example of local election year warfare where you can't beat people on the issues, can't beat people on the merits of your ideas. So you've got to go in and try to get them all buried in legal mumbo jumbo as a distraction. And it's really quite sad. All right, an update on the warning label case. So you might recall we had GOP Chairman Jim Walsh on the show last week to talk about a challenge to a state law that was passed by Democrats for the sole purpose of undermining the initiative process. So what Democrats passed is a law basically saying, hey, if there's an anti-tax initiative that makes it to the ballot, we have to put a warning label next to it to let voters know what they would lose, what the state would lose if you take this money away from them, which is ridiculous because if you're going to do that, then you would have to put a little excerpt saying this is what how much money you'd save if you repealed this tax. But no, it's just about this will ruin everything, transportation, childcare, all this stuff would be taken away. We'd lose so much money. It's basically there to tip the scales. And Democrats would never have sent that through if they were running anti-tax initiatives. The only people who run anti-tax initiatives are conservatives. So that's why they're passing laws explicitly to undermine initiatives from the voters. Voters who are buried under all of these taxes, who want to repeal some of them. So Democrats are like, okay, we can't stop you from gathering enough signatures, although we tried We tried to do that. That didn't work. So now we're just going to undermine you on the ballot. And Jim Walsh had taken this and the state Republican Party sued over it and basically says their argument was, you know, twofold. One, they didn't think that the warning label law actually applied to the three initiatives that are going to be on the ballot in November. But the other issue they have is that's not fair. The Attorney General's office is the office that gets to decide the wording of these warning labels. How is that fair? Is a politician who's running for governor really the person to be able to do the sign off on what the verbiage actually is? So anyway, Jim Walsh was in court on Friday and he lost. So these warning labels are going to be on the ballot in November next to the three initiatives: the initiative to repeal capital gains, the initiative to repeal the Climate Commitment Act, and the initiative to make the long-term care tax optional. This from our friends at the Center Square. Judge rules against Washington GOP challenge to warning labels on ballot initiatives. A judge in Thurston County Superior Court has rejected a legal challenge brought by Washington State Republican Party Chair Jim Walsh to Attorney General Bob Ferguson's ability to put warning labels on initiatives to the fall ballot. Judge Allison Zipp ruled that all three initiatives, one to give workers an opt-out to the WalkCares program, one to repeal the cap and trade program, and one to repeal capital gains, are in fact subject to Washington's public investment impact disclosure statute. During oral arguments Friday, attorney Noah Purcell from the AG's office argued the legislature enacted the public investment impact disclosure statute to provide voters with additional information on the ballot about the fiscal impact of the initiatives they are considering. All three of the measures being considered here today clearly meet criteria for this statute. Attorney Joel Ard made arguments on behalf of the plaintiffs, telling the judge that when it comes to Initiative 2117 to repeal the CCA, putting a warning label on the ballot measure isn't necessary because the CCA is not a tax or a fee. Quote, it's a commodity charge, said Ard. These auction credits that are purchased meet the criteria for being a commodity charge because anybody can buy them. It's not a fee, it's a regulatory fee, and it's not a burden impact fee, it's a commodity charge. So anyway, the judge, having heard both sides of this argument, decided that no, these warning labels in fact get to go into place. From the Center Square, Judge Zipp pushed back, reading a section from the statute that created the PIID. The legislature further finds when a ballot measure will affect further funding of public investments, a neutral, non-prejudicial disclosure of public investments affected would serve that purpose. She suggested lawmakers' intent was to ensure voters understood if initiatives would impact state investments. Quote, it certainly serves the legislature's purpose and clear intent of ensuring that the public should be able to know the fiscal impact that their vote will have on public investments. So this judge, Judge Allison Zipp, saying, yes, these warning labels ought to be on these initiatives. Gosh, her name sounded familiar to Nicole and I. Allison Zipp, Judge Allison Zipp. And then we remembered a case we covered in August of last year where a bunch of juveniles and teenagers were in a stolen vehicle fleeing hidden innocent driver. And then when the police in Thurston County tried to pull them over, fled from the vehicle, two of them hid in a porta potty. And then Judge Allison Zipp said, go on home to your parents. No bail required. Here's a clip from King 5.
A judge checked a box that said there exists a substantial danger that the defendant will commit a violent crime and shall be released, but without having to post any bail.
Yeah, so Judge Allison Zipp said that the defendants were a danger to the community. However, they could be released without posting any bail. Yeah, that's the judge that sided with Attorney General Bob Ferguson's office in saying that these warning labels absolutely have to be on the ballot and aren't designed to tip the scales at all. Wow. A lot of faith in the legal system in our state. But I think things get even worse here because inherently, the idea of having Bob Ferguson, a politician in his office, be the entity to determine whether these warning labels are neutral and non-prejudicial. Okay, so the warning labels are supposed to be neutral and non-prejudicial. What's the problem with Bob Ferguson doing it then? Well, Bob Ferguson doesn't support the initiatives. We knew that, but he's actually now on the record as having said it. The Seattle Times just released its interview with him for its editorial board. And he said in no uncertain terms, he's against the CCA.
So number one, I oppose the initiative, right? So I support the Climate Commitment Act.
Yeah. And he also said on camera that he is opposed to the initiative that would make long-term care optional.
Like the Climate Commitment Act, is it perfect? No, but very few laws are when you first roll them out that are large, right? They're constantly being tweaked and improved, and that's the way I would approach something like that.
Yeah, and we of course know that he's against the initiative to repeal the capital gains tax. So here you have a politician who's a sitting attorney general who is on the record opposed to these three initiatives. And now his office gets to decide on neutral, non-prejudicial language to put next to those initiatives on the ballot to tell Washington voters what their fiscal impacts would be. Yeah. Yeah, our system is absolutely screwed. Our system is absolutely screwed. And the people who want these things, the people who politicians are supposed to be working for, have tried at every juncture to make it more difficult for the will of the people to prevail. I want it to be fair. This was never about, for me, allowing people to have a choice on these things. That's what it's about, plain and simple. Let's give people facts about these issues. Let's let them know how they're impacted by them. And yes, let's let them know how the state budget is impacted by them. And then let's let them make a decision that's best for them and their families. And however that winds up the day after the election, fine. I'll live with that. Because at least voters got to vote. But when you have one side doing everything it can to prevent voters from voting, harassing signature gatherers, failing to pass laws to protect signature gatherers, saying they're saddened by the initiative process, vilifying the initiative process, and now creating special laws to make anti-tax initiatives more difficult to pass at the ballot box. Tell me again how these people work for us. Tell me again how this, in this state, continues to be a government of the people, by the people, for the people. Because that is certainly not what I'm seeing. All right, coming up next, SCOTUS could hear a case. They're going to make a decision coming up in about a week and a half on whether to hear a case against Washington State's eviction moratorium from the pandemic era. We're going to dive into it with a legal expert coming up next. First, if you're in the market to sell your home at some point this year, I highly suggest reaching out to our friend Wes Jones at sellwithwes.com, sellwithwes.com. Wes has been doing this for a long time in this market. Bryce and Carla, who are fans of Undivided, when they decided to sell their home in Bellevue and move to Florida, they reached out to Wes Jones and were very, very happy with what he was able to do for them.
He was extraordinarily detailed, and he knew our neighborhood and our properties in the neighborhood very well. He gave us a really great comp plan, showed us what other properties were selling for, and most importantly, he helped us to understand the dangers of overpricing. And we thought what we knew we could get for the property, but we didn't, at the same time, he breathed an air of reality into us, said, look, guys, you want to get that out of the property, you're going to need to start at a certain point, and you're going to let the market come to you. And that's exactly what happened. He was exactly right about that. So his knowledge of the market and his professionalism and his attention to detail is all that made the difference to us.
Yeah, they were able to sell their home in 7 days for over list price, despite what the market was like in January with the high interest rates. They were very happy with that outcome. So reach out to Wes Jones, sellwithwes.com, sellwithwes.com. Start by using their home value calculator to see how much your home is worth. It might be worth more than you think. Sellwithwes.com, a better way to sell your home. All right, the United States Supreme Court could decide whether to take the case Gonzalez v. Inslee. That has to do with a property owner who sued the state of Washington and Jay Inslee over the eviction moratorium, the near endless eviction moratorium that took place during the pandemic. Now, lower courts did not side in the favor of Gene Gonzalez and his wife, Susan. They're now hoping that SCOTUS will at least hear the case. So we want to talk about that today. This segment is brought to you in partnership with the Rental Housing Association of Washington. One of the things they fight for are property owner rights. If you own property, maybe you're a landlord, do not proceed without becoming a member of RHA, rhawad.org. All right, so in Gonzalez v. Inslee, we want to have a legal expert on the show today to talk a little bit about this case moving forward. His name is Sam Spiegelman. He's associate counsel at the Citizen Action Defense Fund, and he is an expert in the area of property rights. Sam, welcome to Undivided.
Hi, Brandy. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I should, in full disclosure, say you're also helping work on our case through CADIF, our public records lawsuit against the city of Seattle. This interview has nothing to do with that, but we do have that pre-existing relationship. But we want to talk a little bit about property rights today and really, you know, I mean, generally at its core, the government trying to impose itself on a property owner's ability to do with their property what they see fit and how they see fit. Mm-hmm. So there is an interesting moment coming up, June 20th. The U.S. Supreme Court is considering whether to hear a case out of Washington State, Gonzalez v. Inslee, and it has to do with our state's eviction moratorium. Can you give us the ins and outs of it? And actually, you used to work with the attorney who's on this case.
That's correct. Quick shout out to my old colleague, John Houghton at Pacific Legal Foundation. What's interesting about this case is our side, the property rights advocate side, has been trying to get an eviction moratorium case in front of the Supreme Court, and they've swatted a few of them down. We think this might be a promising one. And the rub of it is that Inslee, like a lot of left-leaning governors, imposed an eviction moratorium, obviously, when COVID came about. But the nuts and bolts of it were you could not evict a person past even the end of a lease agreement. So it's not like there were extra protections for the purposes of preserving health and safety. For months and months and months, and well after the ebb and flow of the epidemic, there were still thousands of holdover tenants, you know, also known as squatters. So it's something that with this Supreme Court, a very property friendly Supreme Court, they've been great, but you need to get the case in front of them. So on June 20th, they get behind closed doors, they decide what cases out of the batch that day they're going to take and actually hear in their next term. And we're hopeful, but you know, to be a property rights advocate in America, you have to always be hopeful and be an optimist.
Yeah, for sure. So what would the Supreme Court be weighing in determining whether they want to take this case on?
Yes, so the shortened end of it is that we're just claiming sort of a straightforward takings violation. In the Fifth Amendment of the Constitution, there's a what's called a takings clause. It says, nor shall private property be taken for private use for public use without just compensation. Obviously, those are only 12 words, but like a lot of clauses in the Constitution, there have been thousands and thousands more words written on it and interpretations of it. And when you get down to it, what Washington was forcing landlords to do, and now there are a lot fewer landlords, especially mom and pop landlords in Washington, thanks to regulations like this. What it was trying to get them to do was force them to host tenants well past their lease agreement. Even in some cases, I know for sure this was in California, they even didn't let you remove squatters who had found their way into your property. So hopefully they take it because this can't be repeated. I mean, we're talking about a transfer of many tens of billions of private dollars flowing from out of the pockets of landlords to tenants who, you know, when you abide by your lease agreement and you're there for the term, it's all well and good. But these are tenants that held over well past the end of their term, and nobody's paying the landlord. So they've just had to foot the bill for this public service.
Yeah, I mean, it would have been different. I still would have disagreed with it, but it would have been different when you talk about the constitutionality of it, you know, unlawful taking of private property for public use without just compensation. Now, if the government had, again, I wouldn't agreed with it, but had used taxpayer money to put it in the pockets of those landlords and give them just compensation for their lost revenue, this wouldn't be a case, right?
That's correct. There might be on the margins questions of did they give them the right amount of money? Was it fair market value? But that is the extent of it. And us property rights advocates do often say that we are okay. We are, as a judicial matter, we are okay with subsidization. Yeah. You know, there's a different question of policy, whether that's actually the smart thing to do. But in terms of what the Constitution allows, yes, you can technically. There's some carve outs, but you could force a person to host somebody potentially, but you have to pay them. I mean, you can't. A very strong principle in constitutional jurisprudence. It's called the Armstrong Principle from a 1960 case. And the Supreme Court said that the Takings Clause was designed in all fairness and justice to not to force a small subgroup of the population to bear costs that that are benefiting the public at large. So the same way that we all pay our taxes, we all benefit from taxes paid. There needs to be that sort of reciprocity. When if they're going to host these tenants, then we all should be having to pay for it.
Yeah, yeah. And so just to be clear, this case was lost in the lower courts by Gonzalez, correct? Inslee prevailed in the lower court, so that's why it's being considered before the Supreme Court.
Yes. I'm sure you know, with your case against Seattle, the courts here have something of a mixed bag record, especially when it comes to property rights. And yeah, it failed all the way up, and our state Supreme Court actually declined to hear it. So then it jumps to the federal Supreme Court.
Hey, Sam, I have full faith in the court that our case is before on public records issues. I actually, the city of Seattle has been knocked a lot on public records issues. So I'm fully optimistic they're going to see the light of day on ours.
Let me also, as a participant, caveat that I am talking more about historically the property rights case law in the state, but yeah. We're working hard at it.
Yeah. And Sam, just end with this. You touched on it briefly, but what's at stake here? Obviously, because for Gene Gonzalez, you know, this ordeal is behind him, so to speak, in the sense that we're not in this eviction moratorium for the pandemic. So what's at stake if the Supreme Court takes this case and rules for him or against him?
Well, if it could be monumental. What's funny is the Supreme Court has taken property cases that involve something as simple as running a cable through someone's apartment. The case was called Loretto v. Manhattan Teleprompter Corp., 1982. Just that it was actually argued that the damages was $1. And eventually, when it was remanded back from the Supreme Court, Supreme Court ruled that that landlord had a right to exclude the utility company from his apartment. It ended up only being a dollar worth of damage. But so small cases can make for big splashes. But this isn't even a small case. This, for Washington state at least, but obviously the Supreme Court will have a full nationwide impact on their ruling. We're talking about the difference between a future where landlords in any, the government comes up with any sort of emergency. Obviously, we're living in an age where everything tends to be an emergency. And can just ram through all these regulations and never pay landlords for hosting tenants. So it could be a turning point in what the government is allowed to do and on a grand scale. So it could end up being a very important case, what we call a landmark decision.
Yeah, and I would just add in, even though I said that was the last question, one of the things that's on my radar are the migrants, you know, and asylum seekers and no place to put them. And you have cities right now and jurisdictions asking residents, you know, will you host these asylum seekers? Maybe it's the just, I don't want to say conspiracy theorist in me, or I have this worry given how much the government has done that would become not optional or something. And so, you know, is that way out of bounds to think that that's something that could come
up? No, you're right on the money. That is certainly a plausibility. If something like these eviction moratoriums are let stand, then yes, you can call, just like you called COVID an emergency, and I'm not disputing it, of course, was an emergency, but you could call a homelessness crisis an emergency. And then that would give the government carte blanche to tell people to host people in their homes, which not only goes against the Takings Clause, obviously, but there's it's sort of adjacent to the Third Amendment, little talked about, where you're not allowed to quarter troops in peacetime, but apparently it's possible to be made to host squatters.
Yeah, we might need an update to that Third Amendment. We might need to add a couple additional lines to that one.
Exactly.
All right, Sam, we appreciate it. Thank you for your time and expertise.
Okay, thank you so much, Brandon.
So again, that's Sam Spiegelman. He's associate counsel at CADIF, expert on property rights law. So we will be waiting patiently to see if SCOTUS decides to hear Gonzalez v. Inslee and weigh in on what I do believe is unlawful taking of private property for public use. I mean, the government declaring a state of emergency and basically saying, nope, you've got to just continue to house people, even if they're not paying rent, even if they have no proof that they were financially impacted by the pandemic, and we're going to let it continue on and on and on and not make landlords whole again. So it really seems like a complete invasion of property rights by the government. And I am very curious. If SCOTUS takes it, I feel like SCOTUS will be on the side of the property owner. The question is whether they're going to take the case up. That segment was brought to you by the Rental Housing Association of Washington. If you're a property owner, a landlord in the state of Washington, RHA can have your back to protect you against some of these insane policies. RHAWA.org. RHAWA.org. Become a member today. All right. There have been a couple horrifying instances of juvenile crime and shootings at schools. We're going to get into several of them. But I think what really breaks my heart are adults who react to fear and trauma from kids by turning it into a political issue, in this case, around gun control. Let's get to it in our segment, Unbelievable. All right, so there's a few headlines that really grabbed us today because, you know, we have all sorts of juvenile crime happening in our state. We know we have a juvenile crime crisis. Some of those crimes are more serious than others, but it's shocking to me. I mean, the amount of violent and deadly crime being perpetrated by people who are as young as 13, 14 years old. If we can't see that and recognize, man, we have a serious societal issue on our hands. I don't know what it's going to take. You know, back when we were kids and, you know, if you're an older generation, you might do what? I mean, what's the worst thing you did when you were a kid, Nicole?
I was an angel. What are you talking about?
Drank at parties? Like, drank at parties, yeah, you know?
Probably.
Stayed out past curfew, drank at parties, whatever it was. I mean, we weren't committing armed robberies, you know, right, and shootings and all this stuff. It's just, it's
insane. Spin the
bottle. Spin the bottle, you know, make out in a closet. It's just insane. And I attribute it to a lot of things. I attribute it to phones and living in these virtual worlds where you have a complete disconnect from reality. But we also have a lot of gang issues. We have, I mean, are we Chicago? No. But that's what you're seeing in Chicago with the violence. And so, you know, you have a lot of this crime and violence, stolen vehicles, armed robberies, you know, holdups at convenience stores, smash and grab burglaries, shootings that are tied to organized crime. I don't care if the gang member is 14 years old, 15 years old, 16 years old, or 35 years old. Their crime, their criminal activity is still tied to the same thing. So unless you address the underlying reasons for the criminal activity, you know, going straight to gun control, which is what Democrats always seem to go to, is not going to help the situation at all. What's also not going to help the situation are slaps on the wrist for juveniles who commit serious crime. There's this headline out, Como News, teen sentenced until 21st birthday for deadly 2022 Ingram High School shooting. You might recall this kid was 14 at the time. This happened November of 2022. Shot and killed a kid. Was charged with first-degree murder, assault, illegal gun possession. This happened at Ingram High School in Seattle. And that's the sentence. You get out on your 21st birthday. So 7 years for murder in the first degree. And that's because, of course, that's the standard sentence. If you're a juvenile and you've committed a serious crime, once you turn 21, they let you out, unless they charge you as an adult. Now, why wouldn't you charge even a 14-year-old who clearly was involved in criminal conduct before this shooting? Why would you not charge them as an adult? And so you get 7 years for a homicide? And we're supposed to believe that that is any sort of real punishment or deterrent from anything? Yeah, they talk all the time about, oh, gun control, gun crimes, gun violence. Here you've got a 14-year-old who used a gun they had illegally, obviously, to shoot a kid at school. And on their 21st birthday, they're going to be out of juvie scot-free. That's not going to solve this crime, juvenile crime crisis that we have, not at all. And then more recently, you probably heard about the shooting at Garfield High School, where there was a disturbance between two kids, a fight. Another student tried to break it up. That student was shot and killed. It was like a local rapper, the young person who was shot and killed. Well, after that happened, that's horrifying, right? Kids should be safe at school. But this seems to be clearly gang-related. Clearly gang-related. Like, you got one of the kid who pulls up and shoots him, like, just wearing a gun on his waistband, you know? Like, clearly a gang-related issue. Here's a clip from a Como News story on this.
We still only have one school mental health counselor for 1,300 students at Franklin. And students, if they had access to a mental health counselor, if they had trusted adults that they could talk to anytime they needed, they would not go to a place of violence.
Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? You think that kid is coming up with that all on their own? Oh, if we only had an extra mental health counselor, then what's probably a gang member wouldn't pull out a gun and shoot someone for no reason? Like, mental health counselor is not going to fix that. A mental health counselor is not going to fix that. But that's the kind of stuff adults push. Worthless solutions that don't get to the root cause of the issue whatsoever. And of course, you know, regular politicians coming out, oh, more gun control. These kids aren't, they didn't have the guns legally in the first place. It's not a legal firearm. So what kind of control could you have put on that that would have prevented them from having the gun? None. I asked you guys in our daily subscriber show poll today what you think would be most effective in trying to prevent things like this, because I think all of you collectively are much smarter than the politicians who are pushing ideas like that on kids. Oh, more mental health counselors. Definitely not, by the way. Definitely not school resource officers. Can't have them. Racist. Can't have that. Cops on camp? No, that won't help. But mental health counselors, I really think that some of these young gang members, they would just go right into the office and just lay down on a couch and just get some help for the mental health. For the love. I asked you guys in our daily subscriber show poll, what do you believe would be the most effective deterrent to prevent juvenile crime? Harsher penalties for first offenses? Legal culpability for parents? Or better educational opportunities? And I think you can also bundle that in with better economic opportunities. But which one do you believe would be most effective? Nicole, what do you think? Most effective?
I think it's probably harsher penalties. I don't think they're scared. I don't think they're scared at all.
100% they're not scared. 100% they're not scared. Because, I mean, how many times have we seen the juvies go into court and, you know, that one who was flabbergasted that he wasn't going to be just let go on house arrest after a drive-by right. shooting. He's like, my buddies were basically. It's like, right. Yeah, that's because we've taught them that there are no consequences. So a lot of you are saying harsher penalties for first offenses. E said, though, if parents were on the line for the crimes, they would parent better because they don't want to do the time. Yeah, and honestly, like, I don't know if that's monetary legal culpability or actual criminal legal culpability for parents. I know that's a gray area, but at this point, it almost seems like something that we have to look into. Let me see here. Sally says of what she did when she was younger, I stole a pack of gum from a convenience store when I was about 6 years old. My father marched me back into the store, made me confess and return the gum. It was unopened. Thank you for clarifying. She didn't go in and spit the piece out. I probably got a spanking too. I don't remember. I learned that stealing was wrong and that there were consequences for my behavior. It was a combination of good parenting and consequences back then. Let me see. Hugh says, better educational opportunities. What opportunity? Training on how not to get a gun to pull the trigger? Information that is not nice to steal a car and ram a pot shop to steal the cash? I think what I'm talking about, and this is part of it, but this needs to happen way, way earlier on. I do believe you have a lot of young black men who are involved in gangs. And a gang activity, be it drugs or something else, and then they're profiting from it. That's how they're earning a living, because their economic situations aren't good. And I do believe, and I've said this before, I think we have a whole generation of black Americans that because of this country's past, we're robbed from building generational wealth. The idea is how the challenge is, how do you rectify that without just instituting racist policies like reparations and stuff like that? And so I think for these kids that are, you know, in impoverished homes, economic opportunities, believing that just because, you know, regardless of the color of their skin, that they can achieve whatever, what white kids their age can achieve. So there's a mentality issue, and I'm going to get real deep into the weeds here. There's a lot going on here. But like, what do we do to fix the economic gap there? so that you can decide if, as a young person, like, hey, am I going down the path of I'm going to better myself with an education, find a career path I love, or am I going to join a gang? Because my family's poor, I can get some quick cash from selling dope on the streets or whatever it is. And my dad did it, or my brother did it, so I'm going to do it too. How do you intercede in that earlier on? There's a few ways like that need to happen right now in the state of Washington. First, politicians and people in positions of power like teachers need to stop preaching to these young Black kids that no matter what they do because of the color of their skin, they can't better their circumstances and the entire system is designed to hold them down. That's the message they give them every single day, that the entire system is racist. So if you're Black, if you're a young Black kid and you are being preached from your parents, from other people you respect in the community, from teachers, from coaches, from politicians, that our system is just flat out racist, that there's institutional racism against you because of the pigmentation of your skin, you have a lot less motivation to try, because they make it sound nearly freaking impossible. No matter your God-given talent, no matter your work ethic, they are framing it as, nope, white man's going to hold you down, so don't even try, right? So is it any wonder that they're going into a gang life? Like, I've been told all these adults in my life and politicians and people on TV say everyone's racist. And so how am I supposed to do well at school? How am I supposed to do well in the job market? Why would I dream a dream? Like, no, I'm just going to go sling drugs and carry around a gun. And I'm going to solve my problems that way. So that, first and foremost, the messaging from the top down to these juveniles needs to change fundamentally. Fundamentally. It's sickening what you are pushing in the heads of these young men. Sickening. That you're basically telling them you can be nothing because of the system. How horrible is that? So that first and foremost. And then across the board for kids of all colors, there have to be educational consequences. We're in this like participation trophy. We used to joke about this 5, 10 years ago. Oh, everybody gets a participation trophy. Now they're living participation trophies. Oh, we can't fail kids who show up. Oh, we got lower standards. We have these disproportionate outcomes for testing. So we just, you know, oh, the tests don't matter. No big deal. No, it does matter. Like, kids have to learn that when there's a bar to be met, there are consequences for not meeting that bar. So again, that starts to teach them at an early age that it's okay to fail. It's okay to fall short of expectations and have there be no consequences. Well, no, it's not. No, it's not. Because it's not going to be okay in the real world, in the job market, when you're an adult. That's not going to be okay. DEI. Advancing people because of skin color to make up for historical wrongs when that person might not be the person with the most merit for the opportunity. We've completely let go of meritocracy. So now you're just saying like, hey, like, this person's probably better than you, but since your skin color is Black, like, whoop, go do something that you're not even qualified for. We're going to give you the job for that reason, not because you earned it. Well, what does that teach them? What does that teach them? I'll cheat to get ahead. Use my skin color to get ahead. And I'm not, again, I'm going to get all brandy, it's so racist, blah, blah, blah. Fine. I don't care. I'm sitting here telling you that I reject the soft bigotry of low expectations for young Black men in this country. And that is the mindset that's keeping them down. Their minds, what's been instilled in their brains, is what's keeping them down, is what's pushing them toward a life of crime and not, no, what? No, screw you. I can do better. This is America. Doesn't matter what my skin tone is. This is America in 2024. And I'm going to get a good education, and I'm going to find something I love to do, and I'm going to succeed on my own merits. Because that's possible. If they are convinced that it's possible. But when you have every adult in your life telling you it's not, it is no surprise that so many of these young men are turning to a life of crime. Unbelievable. Shameful. I've encouraged you guys to take the First Mark Challenge. If you're looking to maybe save some money in your family budget, you've cut all the, we're not going out to eat anymore, we're not taking vacations, and we're still just barely getting by, well, take a second look at your insurance. You know, you have to have insurance, obviously, but our friends at First Mark Insurance, wonderful insurance broker who've been doing this for a long time locally. The First Mark Challenge, you basically go to them, you schedule some time, totally free, go over your current insurance, talk about your insurance needs. They go out, they shop the market for you, all the carriers at their disposal. They come back to you and say, hey, here's what we think would be best for you. They might be able to save you some money in the process, get you better insurance for the same price. Our friend Ben Bailey and his wife Leslie did the First Mark Challenge. They're now saving $1,500 a year.
You know, more than anything, it was really kind of drilling down and looking at the current coverages that we have today. And if those were adequate for, you know, say, if we had a major incident here at the house, you know, were our cars covered adequately, or were they actually, in our case, over covered, right? We have one car that's fairly new and another one that's a few years old. And the one that was a few years old actually has had too much coverage on it. So that helped as well.
See, and that stuff, I mean, gosh, if you're ever navigating the insurance industry by yourself, you're like, I don't know, that's probably good. They're probably not giving me coverage I don't need. Yeah, I wouldn't trust them on that. So reach out to First Mark Insurance. Take the First Mark Challenge today. The very best part is they work for you, not the insurance companies. All right, let's step outside of Washington State, get to some national news. So there's some leaked audio of Nancy Pelosi. One of the things I think is interesting about this is it's apparently by her own daughter, Alexandra Pelosi. She's like doing an HBO documentary. So her own daughter's kind of like ratting her out inadvertently or on purpose. I don't know. But let's just play the audio of Nancy Pelosi and then I'll give you a little additional context on it. Here we go.
We have responsibility, Terry. We did not have any accountability for what was going on there, and we should have. This is ridiculous. You're going to ask me in the middle of the thing when they've already breached the inaugural stuff that should we call the Capitol Police? I mean, the National Guard? Why weren't the National Guard there to begin with?
They thought that they had sufficient resources.
That is not a question of how they had been. They don't know. They clearly didn't know, and I take responsibility for not having them just prepare for more.
Huh. So Nancy Pelosi says she takes responsibility for not having them prepare for better security ahead of January 6th. Let the National Guard come in, you know, let Capitol Police, have there be more security in the area. So here she is on tape taking some level of responsibility. And now I'm not going to do that thing where I say, oh, Nancy Pelosi did this, so Trump's completely off the hook. January 6th was an embarrassment. Had it been Black Lives Matter protesters, I think every single Republican would have said it's an embarrassment as well. So let's just all be morally consistent here. But this from the New York Post, with a little additional context. Former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi blamed herself for the lack of National Guard troops at the U.S. Capitol on January 6th, 2021. Video footage released by House Republicans on Monday showed. As rioters stormed the seat of Congress, Pelosi, 84, fumed about the lack of accountability and accepted responsibility for a lack of security ahead of former President Donald Trump's Stop the Steal rally. The video clip, shot for an HBO documentary by the congressman's daughter, Alexandra Pelosi, showed. A report on the riot, authored by House Republicans in 2022, found that Democratic leadership had concerns over the optics of having National Guard troops present at the Capitol in the aftermath of the summer 2020 Black Lives Matter protests. A spokesperson for Pelosi dismissed the video clip released by House Republicans, accusing them of attempting to whitewash January 6th. And then Pelosi was also asked about Nicole Wallace, the host on MSNBC, basically said, what do you make of this clip coming out and Republicans losing their mind about it? Here's her answer.
The fact is that the president of the United States, the former president, and his toadies do not want to face the facts. They're trying to do revisionist history on January 6th. But we cannot let us be dragged into their, again, false impression of what happened that day. They know what happened that day.
Look, I do think some Republicans are first of all, she just cannot put words together. Her and Joe, it's really rough. I do think some Republicans have tried to be revisionist about January 6th. Absolutely, 100%. Again, I go back to actions before affiliation. I'm going to judge someone's actions before I give any consideration for their political affiliation and whether I agree with them. You know, there's a lot of frustration that Here we let rioters tear down and burn down cities in 2020 and said nothing and even had Seattle City Council members joining them on the protest line. That was cool. And then January 6th, absolutely darkest day in our nation's history. So there's a lot of inconsistency from both sides, clearly, on what acts of political violence and rioting are acceptable and which ones are not. So they're both just absolutely full of shit. But Nancy Pelosi, you know, she hides behind this excuse of, She hides behind this excuse of they're trying to be revisionist without addressing what she said. Remember, Democrats were like, Donald Trump basically blocked us from having National Guard and all this security that should have been in place, when there were clearly, she's saying in there, almost upset that he would ask mid-protest riot for bring National Guard in. She's like, well, we should have had National Guard in beforehand. So if you're really being serious about it, which she's incapable of being serious about it, then she would get on MSNBC and she would be like, you know what? Yeah. I said it on tape, obviously. I do think Congress should have done more to ensure that there was proper security presence ahead of it. More of a presence from the National Guard, more of a presence from Capitol Police, from DC Police, whatever it is. But, and she could have said, but that doesn't condone or excuse what happened. See how those two things, see how that's very easy? How those two things can happen at once? Like, yeah, we dropped the ball. Should have had more security. But that doesn't condone what they did. And I would have agreed with that 100%. All right, we're going to get into questions and comments coming up next. Man, I love it when I log on in the live chat on YouTube. We already got super chats dropped before I even say anything. It's like, well, what if it's a crappy show? And now you just gave me a super chat and then I just bomb.
Well, it wasn't a crappy show, so you're safe.
You know, we'll find out. It's not over yet. All right, Zach Abraham and his team at Bulwark Capital are having another one of their free risk seminars. This one, again, is specifically about inflation. They just had one a few weeks ago. It was so popular that they wanted to have another one. So this one is happening on June 27th. Go to knowyourriskradio.com, knowyourriskradio.com. They call inflation the silent portfolio killer. And the reason is obvious. You've been saving for retirement, gearing up. Hey, here's what kind of retirement I have. So here's how much money I saved. Well, then when the cost of everything goes up, all of a sudden that money you saved isn't going to go as far, is it? Not going to have the kind of retirement that you had planned for. So that's what Zach Abraham and his team at Bulwark Capital can walk you through on this live webinar. Totally free. You can join the webinar and listen passively if you want. You don't have to ask any questions or anything like that. And then while you're at it, you can also learn a little bit about risk to your retirement portfolio. You know, it's an election year. You got all this global unrest happening, really unpredictable markets, market volatility. So especially if you're getting close to retirement, do this for yourself. Make sure your retirement isn't needlessly exposed to risk, too much risk. There's always risk associated, of course, but also make sure that your retirement is well equipped to handle this crazy inflation we're having. So sign up, 3:30 p.m. Pacific time, June 27th, knowyourriskradio.com, knowyourriskradio.com. It is completely free. Investment advisory services offered through Trek Financial LLC, an SEC registered investment advisor. Investments involve risk and are not guaranteed. Past performance doesn't guarantee future results. Trek 24244. Go to knowyourriskradio.com. All right, jumping into, I'm rich. People ask me all the time, how do I do super chats? So super chats is a function that's only available on YouTube and you have to be logged into your YouTube account. So if you're on Patreon watching, you already support the show. You're subscribers. Don't feel like you need to do super chats. But if you want to do super chats, we always read them. Bill Biz with a $20 super chat. Brandy and Nicole, have you heard any recent polling data concerning the Serrano-Dingra AG race? First of all, don't ever say that again. It is going to be the Serrano-Nick Brown race. Pray to God. Like, Nick Brown, I'm still a questionable Democrat, but Dingra would be disastrous. So let's just pretend that Dingra is not even going to come close to making it past the primary, please, just for my mental sanity. I haven't seen any polling on that, but I will be on the lookout. And we need to invite Nick Brown and Monica Dingra on the show because we've had Pete Serrano. Nicole, you think Monica will join us?
I've asked her before. I haven't heard back, but
You probably went to
junk mail.
Yeah. No, 100%. We'll send a letter, a certified letter via USPS. So we'll do that and just make sure it gets to her. The Outlaw Feminist with a $50 super chat. I have a really good story for you that will bring a lot of light to the Washington elites. I have receipts, experience, knowledge, and documentation. I can help. Thank you for any time you give me. All right. Email us, undividedpod.com, undividedpod.com. There's a little feature where you can reach out to us. Also, the Outlaw Feminist with a $25 super chat explaining that story. The state of Washington is disarming women and holding them captive here in order to traffic them. What? All right. If you got evidence on that, like, hey, You send that our way. $1.99 super chat from a no one, no screen name. Welcome to the Chin Hair Club, ladies. $4, money for tweezers. Oh, nice. We're talking on the show yesterday about our chin hairs gone wild. Uh-huh. I had a couple men text me like, why? I'm like, oh, come on. Come on.
Well, they have a lot to go wild.
Right?
They just allow it.
You just allow it. You know, nose hair is growing out and ear hair and stuff. At least we trim ours.
Right.
We're humans too, okay? Matt Gilbert with a $5 super chat. If the government can use emergencies to break the law, the government will keep coming up with emergencies, 100%. That's the point I was making during that interview with Sam from Cadiff, that, you know, the government, unlawful taking of property. You know, the government says you've got to keep people in your homes, can't evict them. We're going to make it nearly impossible to do that. Doesn't matter if it's costing you tens of thousands of dollars a year. What's to say they're not going to do that with migrants? What's to say migrant crisis, emergency declaration, that they're not going to do that? I don't think that's tinfoil hat stuff.
Not anymore.
I think that's very used to.
At some
5 years ago, I'd have been like, you're crazy.
Mm-hmm.
But I was also crazy 5 years ago. Now here we are, red-pilled up the wazoo. Greg Olakis, if little Bob is running for governor, he needs to recuse himself from any of this. This is some shady shh right here. I agree. Mm-hmm. Tried to make me swear there for the swear jar. I already did that once. Lieutenant Dan 457, Grand Theft Auto and crimes with guns involved need to see mandatory minimums, regardless of age. 100%. We talked about this, the guy who murdered his ex-girlfriend in cold blood, and then prosecutors gave him a sweet plea deal and got rid of a mandatory firearm enhancement of 5 years. That's crazy. You cannot, through one side of your mouth, talk about how bad guns are, and then on the other side of your mouth say, oh, let's take it easy on criminals who use guns. That's mental. That's mental.
Or again, using that five-year enhancement for guns to bargain.
Right. No, that's not a bargaining chip. 100%. That's sick to use it as a bargaining chip. D-Man in Seattle, totally insane. There is no limit once judges reinvent the meaning of words. The letter kills, the spirit gives life. What is that in regards to?
The judge.
Maybe. Okay. Yeah. Stacy, if these kids have guns illegally, I doubt they're even in school to make use of these mental health counselors. Yeah, they're doing gang stuff on the streets. They're not like, hey, buddy, I can't go for that smash and grab with you today because I gotta see the counselor at school. That's not happening. It's just insane.
It's really crazy, but I feel like these kids are now craving that attention that these protests and everything get, because all these media outlets go and they're still not getting that mental health help that they need or whatever, and so now the kids are like, let's go protest. So the whole day, instead of learning things in class, they're protesting.
Yeah.
And it's supported and it's going nowhere and it doesn't actually help anyone.
They protest everything, and then there's no consequence.
Right. And I wish kind of that the media would stop putting so much attention on, because I don't think you're not helping them.
Oh, the 14-year-olds are walking out of class today. Quick, get down there with your camera. Let's get this on the 5 o'clock news. Mm-hmm. No, just ignore them. Just ignore them. Now, that being said, mental health counselors in school, I think, is a good idea, given the fact that we have a mental health crisis with kids.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know that I particularly trust a school-appointed medical health counselor. You know, your kid's going to go in there perfectly fine. They're going to come out transgender.
Right, so exactly.
I think maybe if your kid's having a mental health issue, I'm not telling you how to parent, but maybe find a therapist that comes highly recommended as opposed to the therapist that is working in our public education system. But still, like, we got to start with this mental health crisis somewhere. But, you know, take the phones away. Take the phones away from the kids, and that'll do an awful lot of good on the mental health front. Steve Lazarus, I love your last name, by the way. Isn't that a Bible character?
Should Lazarus?
Can I say character? Is that offensive? Isn't that a person in the Bible?
Oh.
Nicole, you should know
likely.
This.
Yeah.
Lazarus.
Yeah.
You're the religious one.
Yeah, well, you know, it's been a while since I went to confirmation.
Oh, you don't read the Bible every night?
Whoa.
Okay. I'm pretty sure that I just pulled out a Bible fact. But who knows?
Yeah, somebody tell us in the chat.
$19.99 super chat. Keep fighting the good fight. Shirley Lopez on youth crime. When there's no consequences for small crimes, there's no fear of committing a serious crime. Right. Because what you want to do is you want to stop them before it gets serious. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So if you give them slap on the wrist, like, oh, it's only shoplifting. Or it's only, you know, they got in a fight with someone. That's all it is. It's like, okay. However, wouldn't it be better to throw the book at them now when it's like maybe some community service time, a couple days in jail or something like that, or a fine, throw the book at them now, whatever you can do to a juvenile. And then maybe they won't commit an armed robbery. Maybe they won't kill their classmate because they've already tasted what the law tastes like. Tasted the law. Whatever. You get it.
Tasted.
I was going somewhere. Anyway, fell short.
But I also think that making kids go to school, like you were saying, that they're passing kids that just show up for class, but they're passing kids that aren't showing up for class. And I actually think that that's a bigger issue as well, because, I mean, I know a child that doesn't go to school very often and is still going to graduate and just kind of gets by. And he's not being done any favors.
No.
And the kids that are, you know, allowed to do that at home and things like that, it's not, you're, the schools and, you know, the superintendent of public education is not helping anybody, any of those children, by saying, it's okay, we'll just float you through. We'll just get you by. You just need a degree, or you just need a diploma, and then you'll be fine in life. No. You need to show up to school, make connections, make relationships, and have a normal childhood.
We'll float the real world can crush your hopes and dreams.
Right. And there used to be this, like, Becala. I mean, it's still a thing, but it doesn't get enforced in the same way. You don't have to, there's not a, they've laxed it since COVID, and it needs to come back, and parents need to be held accountable when their kids don't show up for school as well.
100%. 100%. We did get quite a few responses on Lazarus. Apparently, let me see here. There's a couple good, a figure within the Christian Bible mentioned in the New Testament in the Gospel of John, who 4 days after his death is restored to life by Jesus.
There you go.
I knew you guys would know. So there you go, Nicole. Hey, I'm happy. Appreciate I could teach you something about your own religion.
Thank you. You're welcome.
All right. With that, we'll get to our closing sanity check. Margaret Brennan, apparently very surprised that a majority of Americans want to remove illegal immigrants from the country. All right, so immigration is going to continue to be a huge issue, obviously, in this election year. No surprise there. So this clip is from Face the Nation with Margaret Brennan. And I like Margaret Brennan, typically. I mean, I think, you know, there's always a little bias going around in network news. But was utterly shocked that 60% of the people they polled want to deport all, yes, I said all, illegal aliens.
Deport all people living in the U.S. illegally. And that finds majority favor. That finds 6 in 10.
So unpack that a bit, because this 62% of Americans favor deporting all undocumented immigrants. So Homeland Security says that President Biden has already deported or repatriated more people in the past year than any year since 2010. And then, depending on the details of what's talked about on the campaign trail, some of what Mr. Trump talks about could be illegal. It doesn't seem practical in some sense to round up children. And then we know that the courts have questioned whether local authorities would have the ability to do it, and federal authorities don't have the resources. So what exactly do people think they're supporting?
People think that they're supporting getting control over our immigration crisis. And it doesn't matter whether it's practical. It doesn't matter if Trump even is going to do it, if constitutionally he could do it. What you're seeing there is a reflection of Americans being deeply, so deeply frustrated with the border crisis that they just want every single person who's in the country illegally to be sent back home. And if that isn't a warning flag for Democrats ahead of November, I don't know what it is. That has been your sanity check for today. That has been today's episode of Undivided. Thank you for being here. Thank you so much for your commitment to giving common sense a comeback. If you have not supported the show already, you can do that for just $5 a month by signing up at undividedpod.com. That's undividedpod.com. While you're there, you can shop our merch store 25% off when you use the promo code sanity24. That's sanity and the number 24. We'll see you guys back on the live show tomorrow at noon.